Anyone here for the first time?
Okay.
Well, we'll start now. You are all welcome. And last time we discussed about the Buddha, and today also we'll be talking about the Buddha. We started with the modern theory of evolution. We pointed out that the human being that we find today is not the ultimate stage in the evolutionary process, that the human being has to evolve further. The human being has a brain which is much more evolved than all the other animals. But still, the human being has certain things that have to be removed. You know, the animals are mainly dominated by emotion. That means, according to the modern biological way of thinking, the difference between the ape and the human being is that the ape is passively reacting to the environment, whereas the human being has a special ability to delay that reaction, to get sufficient time to think and decide what is the best response to make in a given situation. Now that means, but we also find that normally all human beings are not all the time being doing that. That means every human being is not just rationally responding to things, because we are all the time reacting emotionally. So this is where we have to evolve further, and that further evolution is an evolution of the consciousness. Normally, we are conscious of external things. What we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, we are aware of. But we are not fully aware of what is going on inside us. We don't know what is happening inside our body. When we are sick, we have to go to the doctor. The doctor is supposed to know better than us about our own bodies. So in the same way, when something happens in our mind, again, we have to go to a psychiatrist or psychotherapist, because that person seems to know better about our own mind. So we have to go there. That means we are not fully aware of what is going on inside us. So if our consciousness has to evolve, it has to evolve by becoming aware of what is going on inside. Now, this becoming aware of what is going on inside is what we call insight meditation. This is something that the Buddha taught. Not only that he taught this, he became aware of this himself. And he became fully conscious. We are only half conscious. Not only half, even maybe about one third or one sixth, maybe, because we are not fully conscious. This is why the psychologists talk about the unconscious, which is a part of our mind that we are not conscious of. And the unconscious is like an iceberg. Only the top is the conscious part, and there is a huge part under the water. Like that, what we are unconscious of is greater than what we are conscious of. So this is why we have to become more conscious. And we have to, now the Buddha points out that we are dreaming really. And we have to awaken from that state. So this is why a Buddha, the word Buddha means the awakened one who has awakened, so that there is no unconscious for the Buddha. He's fully conscious. That's the important thing to understand. And this process of meditation is learning to become fully conscious. It's only when we become fully conscious that we begin to transcend all human weaknesses and we become superhuman or supernormal. Now, modern psychotherapy is trying to make abnormal people normal. But this Buddhist way is to make normal people supernormal. That's the important thing to understand. So, this is something that we discussed last time. And we also discussed something more the second time. And that was that when we begin to evolve beyond what we are today, we come to a stage where the human being begins to gain certain psychic powers. We discussed these psychic powers last time. These are called the Pancha Abhinya, the five super knowledges, the ability to gain control over the body so that we are able to do wonderful things, what most in the West people call miracles. These are actually normal, natural psychic powers that some yogis are said to perform some of these things even today. But during the time of the Buddha, there were more wonderful things than what you hear of today. So these five things were the ability to perform some of these psychic powers, like walking on water or plunging into earth or flying in the air or recalling past lives, and the divine eye, which is called like X-ray vision or telescopic vision, microscopic vision, things like that. And also the ability to read other people's thoughts and to hear sounds that are coming from other worlds. So that these are some psychic powers that a normal person, after evolving further, is able to perform some of these things. Now, today, we are going to discuss another important topic, and that is what I call Buddhology. Now, say, Christians have a thing called theology, talking about God. One very important thing to realize, which has been not realized by most writers on Buddhism and misinterpreted, and that is, people say that Buddhism is atheistic. But I think Buddhism is not atheistic, nor is it theistic. Avoiding atheism and theism, Buddhism takes a middle path, which is humanism, humanistic. Now, the difference between theistic thinking and humanistic thinking is that theistic religions believe that religion is something that has come down from heaven to earth, carrying the message of the Creator. And the Creator is supposed to be in heaven. And the practice of religion is to obey the commandments of this Creator. And if you follow the commandments, you'll be rewarded by going to, you'll be taken to heaven. If you don't follow the commandments, you will be thrown into hell, an eternal damnation. Or you can have eternal life if you follow the command. Now, the humanistic way of thinking is different. Modern scientific thinking is humanistic thinking, which means that the human being and the ability of the human being is what is valued. And religion is seen as something that has grown up on earth, not come down from heaven. It has grown up on earth to satisfy a human need, to solve a human problem. That's the humanistic way of thinking. Now, Buddhism is a humanistic religion. The teaching of the Buddha has been summed up in the form of the Four Noble Truths. You may have read about this. And the Four Noble Truths is actually a description of that problem and its solution. The problem is that our existence itself is a suffering, that we are unhappy. That's the problem. And it is the same problem that the theistic religions, they also try to solve, although they don't admit that. Because they are all the time talking about eternal life and eternal pleasure, happiness in heaven. Why do they talk about eternal life and eternal happiness? Because what they find in this world is happiness that is impermanent and life that is impermanent. That itself is the problem that the Buddha is trying to solve. But not by seeking eternal life or eternal pleasure. That's the difference. What the Buddha points out is that we have to face the facts of life. The fact is that everything in this world comes into being due to the presence of certain conditions. When those conditions are present, it comes into being. When the conditions are absent, it disappears, like a flame. Now, if you strike a match, you get a flame. How do you get the flame? Partly because of the friction, partly because of the gunpowder or whatever there is in the match, and also because there is oxygen in the air and so many other conditions necessary. So when those conditions are there, the flame comes into being. When the conditions are absent, then the flame disappears. In the same way, our life, if we don't have food, we die. If we don't have water, we die. If we don't have the proper temperature, we die. If we don't have the proper pressure, we die. If we don't have oxygen in the air, we die. All those things are necessary for us to survive. So the survival of everything in this world is dependent on conditions. This is why there is a word that is being used to describe this. And that word is called determinism. It's determinism. Now some, of course, when I use the word determinism, think I am talking about predeterminism. Predeterminism means that everything was decided by someone like God who created the world and everything happens according to that determination. That is predeterminism. But when you say determinism, we are talking about something happening due to the presence of the necessary condition. The conditions determine whatever is happening. In ancient times, people thought that all these natural phenomena like thunder, lightning, or even earthquakes, or tornadoes, or whatever there is, things, floods that happen, even rain, all that is done by some kind of spirit controlling the universe. That's how even this idea of a creator came into being. But today, through the progress of science, people have begun to understand this determinism, that everything happens due to the presence of certain necessary conditions. But still, all of us think that inside us, what is going on inside our body is controlled by some soul or self inside us. When I think, there is some self inside thinking. When I speak, there is some self inside speaking. When I act, there is some self inside doing the acting. But modern psychologists like Freud used the word called psychic determinism. That means even our mind is controlled by these necessary conditions. Whatever happens, even when a thought occurs, it happens because certain conditions are there for it to happen. When I speak a word, certain conditions are there. When I act in any way, that's also determined by certain conditions. That is psychic determinism. Now, this is a fact that the Buddha pointed out. When we are able to fully understand this, then we become completely selfless. All self-centered thinking, all selfishness, all fighting, quarreling, wars, crime, all that can disappear. And there'll be consideration for others. We become unselfish. Then only we can have what we call real love, which is selfless love, not the self-centered passion. Selfless love is possible only when the idea of self has disappeared. That's the important thing to understand. Now, what I was trying to point out was that this evolved state of the human being is what is truly called God in Buddhism also. So this word God is there in Buddhism, but people don't know about it. Even the Buddhists don't know about it. The word that the Buddha used was Brahman. The word Brahman means God with the capital G. There is another word, Deva, which is related to the Latin word Deus, but the Deva. Now, in the Buddhist commentaries, we have an analysis of this word, and then is spoken described in this way there, that three meanings of the word Deva. One is called Sammuti Deva. Sammuti Deva means a god. If we use the word Deva as God with a simple G, Sammuti Deva is God by convention or conventional God, which means that some people speak of God of love or God of war or God of lightning or God of thunder or rain or something like that. These are just conventions that people in certain cultures or even ancient cultures, they began to think that way. That's just a convention. Or even kings were regarded as God. And when these kings die, they begin to think of these departed kings as gods. And they might pray to these gods. Or maybe ancestral worship, worshipping ancestors. But this is all a convention, just a belief. Then there is another kind of God, which is called Uppatti Deva. Uppatti means God by birth. This means that Buddhists believe that there are other worlds like heavens or celestial worlds not visible to the human eye or human beings cannot see. But there are these other spheres of existence. And these beings who are living in those worlds called the Deva worlds, they are also called gods. So that's the God, which is called God by birth, because they are born in that particular world, God by birth, inhabitants of heavens, for example. But in English, usually we use the word angel to refer to some of these inhabitants of heaven. Then there is a third category that is called Visuddhi Deva. Visuddhi Deva means God by purity of mind. If a mind has been purified, then that person with the pure mind is called God. Now, it is with that we can define the word God with the capital G. Because it's just God doesn't mean just the creator. God means one who is pure in mind, good, loving, also all-knowing, all-powerful, all those things. Those are the attributes of God. So if there is a person who has those attributes, such a person is called God. Now, the Buddhist way of thinking is not that the world was created by a God. God is a human concept. It's not that God created man, but man created God in his mind. So the human being has formed a concept, and that concept is the concept of perfection. So the human being conceives the idea of perfection. And having conceived this ideal of perfection, the human being begins to try to be perfect. And that is the practice of religion. Religion is an effort to realize that ideal of perfection. And ultimately, that ideal can be reached. That ideal can be reached. What's the problem?
No, it's colder and colder at the end.
Huh. You start working, huh?
No, it's not.
Oh, okay. So, when a human being reaches that state of perfection, that person becomes God. So such a person is the Buddha. So when we speak of the Buddha, he's not just some philosopher who lived so many centuries ago, like Socrates or Plato. This was a person who evolved to that point where the human being realizes the ideal of perfection. It's a human potential that has been actualized. And that is a Buddha. So one important difference between the Christian way of thinking and the Buddhist way of thinking is that a Christian would say a human being can never become perfect. Only God is perfect. But in actual fact, Jesus Christ in the Gospel say, "Be ye perfect, as your father was perfect." He believed in the ability of a human being to become perfect. That's why I say that Jesus was a Buddhist, not a Christian. So, and also he said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." That is not once you have purified your mind, you'll see God somewhere there, but you'll be seeing God within you, because the kingdom of God is within you, not outside. So it was very clear. And somehow, the important thing that we have to understand is that from a Buddhist point of view, God is one whose mind has been fully purified. Now, what do we mean by purifying? Purifying simply means the mind being free of these self-centered emotions. All emotions are self-centered. That's what Freud said. All emotions are self-centered because they are all mainly to survive. The whole process of evolution is a struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest. So the animals are mainly making use of emotion to survive. So all emotions are for that purpose. Now what we call love in the form of sexual love is also an emotion, and the main purpose of that is to propagate the species. But today they try to avoid propagating and enjoy the pleasures. But that is not the real purpose of this. It was to propagate the species. Just as the bees are attracted by the flowers and given all the nectar so that the flower can be propagated. So in a similar way, the sexual attractions and various hormones and various other things that go into it, all that is for the purpose of propagating the species. They're all self-centered. So the real selfless love is not a self-centered thing. The selfless love or the selfless interest in the welfare of all beings, which we call metta or maitri in Sanskrit, metta in Pali. We don't have a proper word for this in English. But that psychotherapist or psychiatrist or psychoanalyst, Erich Fromm, wrote a book called The Art of Loving. There he mentions that he uses three Greek words to describe this. One is eros. Eros means the sexual love. That is a self-centered love. The other one is philia. It's a family love. The love between parents and children and brothers and sisters. That sort of love. Philia. Then he uses a third word called agape, which is the selfless love. If you say, love thy neighbor as thyself, that is a selfless love. So when you become interested in the welfare of others without thinking of your own benefit, that is selfless love. This is what we call metta or maitri. That becomes possible only when our mind is free of these self-centered emotions. According to the Buddha, there are two self-centered basic emotions. One is the desire for pleasure. The other is the hatred of pain. Those are the two basic emotions. And there is also a third one, which is actually a confusion of the mind due to the presence of these self-centered emotions. Like when we get angry. When we are angry, we are not able to see what is right and wrong. We might even fight with our parents who really love us. And some people kill their mother or father. And then later they repent. So they do things when they are excited. They do certain things for which they repent later. This is because the emotion, when they are excited, they make you blind. That's why they say love is blind. Not only love, anger is also blind. Fear is blind. All these emotions are blind. We can do all kinds of things, silly things that we repent later. Now, to purify the mind is to free our mind of these self-centered emotions. And when our mind is free of these emotions, then we can think clearly. Otherwise, we'll be thinking that we are really doing logical thinking, but our thinking becomes illogical. Sometimes other people can see that our thinking is illogical, but we don't see it. We try to defend ourselves. That's what is called rationalization. We rationalize the emotion. We try to support the emotion by logical argument. So the important thing I was trying to convey was that for the Buddhist, Buddha, he is the God with the capital G. That a human being can reach a state of perfection. And we are all trying to reach that state of perfection. Although we may not have risen up to that level. We have to understand this. So this is the Buddhist theology, what I call Buddhology, that the Buddha is not just an ordinary human being, as some writers try to put it. And it is a disadvantage to think that the Buddha was just a human being. And not only that, there is another objection to that. If we tell a Christian the Buddha was a human being, the Christian will say, oh yes, the Buddha was a human being, therefore he is bound to be wrong. Christ was God, therefore he can never be wrong. And so it's better to, I think even in the Buddhist countries, most people when they write, they say Buddha was a human being. I think that lesson was taught by the Christians themselves who came to the Buddhist country and taught the people there. Because their argument is, Buddhism is atheistic. And the moment you say you don't believe in God, it means that you are a bad person. We have such a word in Buddhism. We call it Miccha Ditti, wrong view. If a person is having the wrong views, that person is a bad person. That's why most Buddhists think that Christians are evil people. Just that the Christian thinks that Buddhists are evil people. You see? But when I came to this country, most people were Christians. I found that they were very good people. From my point of view, I would say they are very good Buddhists. Because we have been brought up to think that only Buddhists are good people and all the non-Buddhists are bad people. Just that the Christians were taught that only Christians were good people and those who were not Christians were bad people. This is just an ordinary cultural prejudice. So it's very important when we talk about the Buddha to point out that the Buddha was God. That is how the Buddhists see the Buddha as God. Not, we don't mean that Buddha was the creator of the world, because according to the Buddhist way of thinking, whoever created the world has created suffering. And then, if the creator had created suffering, he can't be God. So that's why we have a different term for the creator, if he was a creator. That is Mara. Mara, of course, literally means death. But Mara is the word for the devil. So in other words, the creator cannot be God. He has to be the devil. This is why I heard in Zoroastrianism, there were two gods. One who created what is good and another who created all the evil in the world. Auramazda and Ahriman. So one was the creator of all the good things in the world and the other one was the creator of all the bad things in the world. But actually, if we look at all this religious symbolism, what we see is that all the good and the evil are within the human beings. And the whole purpose of religion is to get rid of the evil within the human being and to cultivate what is good and to purify the mind. This is the meaning of religion. When we understand it that way, then all we see the unity in all religions. These differences in different religions is simply produced by the way they explain what they are doing. But they are all doing the same thing ultimately. They are all trying to be good and they are all trying to unite with God. What is to unite with God? The moment you unite with God, you become God. Like a river that falls into the ocean and it becomes the ocean. The water unites with the waters of the ocean. So in the same way, if we purify our mind, that purity itself makes you God. In other words, this is a potential that human beings gradually try to actualize. through the practice of religion. So I think I have said what I had to say, and we have been speaking for about 1 hour now. So I'll let you ask questions and we can discuss. Any questions? Yeah?
Read. Last week you were so kind to give us a reading list, and I didn't have a pencil and paper with me, and I was wondering if you could repeat the names of the books that you had suggested to read.
Ah, okay. I hope you'll be able to write it down and...
And I will Xerox it and bring it in.
Oh, that's a good idea, yeah. So the first book I told you was not written by a person who called himself a Buddhist. Is As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. Then the second book was written by a British author who was a journalist who went to Sri Lanka also and learned or studied Buddhism. It's The Mind Unshaken by John Walters. Another book was written by Paul Karras. His Gospel of the Buddha by Paul Karras. C-R-R-U-S. The other is Buddhism in Translation by Henry Clark Warren. After reading those things, I would suggest that you should read the sutras. Today you get the sutras in translation, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. B-O-D-H-I, Bodhi. And so those are the books. So any... other questions about what we discussed? Yeah, you have a question.
Mentioned Mara.
Yeah.
And I've heard that term before, and I just wanted you to...
I don't hear you properly. Can you stand up and say it? We like to see your face also.
You mentioned Mara, the Buddhist version of the devil, and I've heard that term before, but I was hoping that you could maybe elaborate on it a little bit more.
What do you want to know about that?
What you were talking about, you were saying that he and that people considered him the creator of the universe. Now, I'd never heard that before, and I'm wondering if you have some, if Buddhism has a an explanation for the creation of the universe, why anything exists and with nothing, and whether any of that has to do with Mara, all of that.
Well, I didn't say that the Buddhists believe that Mara created the world. No. The important thing to understand is that the word Mara and the word Brahma has been used by the Buddha as symbols that represent goodness and evil. And this is the same thing found in other religions, where, of course, they don't look at it as a symbol, but as a reality. That's the difference. But in Buddhism, God and the devil are seen as symbols representing goodness and evil. And the other thing is, the other question is very important also, which is that people believe in a creator. And people often ask, who created the world? Once... I was invited to go and talk to some prisoners in prison. There was a monk, a Mahayana monk, who was frequently going to the prisons and talking to the prisoners about Buddhism and teaching meditation. So he asked me to join him one day and asked me to give a talk there. So I finished the talk, and then one young man got up and asked, who created the world? So I said, you created the world. When I said that monk got frightened. He thought that I was going the wrong track. And he didn't allow me to speak after that. He started talking. So I kept silent. That's all. But the important thing there that I was trying to say, I wanted him to ask me the second question. What do you mean by I created the world? But I was not allowed to answer that part. So I can answer it now if you want. Do you want me to answer that? You see, there is a verse immediately after his awakening from this dream. The Buddha recited a verse, or supposed to have recited the verse, or whatever ideas came out was put in the form of a verse. It's a common thing that Buddhists in Sri Lanka have heard very often. In Pali it goes like this: Aneka jati sansaran sanda visan anibbisan gahakarakan gave santo dukkha jati punapuna. What it means is, I have been traveling in this sansara. Sansara is the cycle of rebirth. I have been going in search of the house builder, which means the creator. So in other words, now the Buddha is saying, I have been traveling in sansara from life to life in search of the creator. But I didn't find him. I didn't meet him. And then he says, it's this repeated birth is a suffering. Going from life to life, every time you are born, you die again. That's a suffering. Then he says, now I have seen you, Creator. You will not create again. All your structure has been destroyed. All the supporting pillars have been broken down. Visankara gatan chittan, the mind has stopped creating. The emotional urge has been destroyed. That is, the meaning is that we are creating the world through our own mental process. If you study modern psychology, if you study what is called the theory of perception, you will understand this. This is known to modern psychologists. Everything that we see in the world is a construct. When we open our eyes, we don't really see objects. That's the important thing to understand. Because in our eyes, what we get is there's a thing called the retina. And there, the optic nerve comes to that point. And there, in the optic nerve, there are small nerve endings. It's a collection of nerve endings. There, each nerve ending can only be stimulated by a certain frequency of light. So there are different, really, seven frequencies: violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, red. And those nerve endings will carry messages to the brain. So what you see is color, nothing else. That's all that you see. But out of this field of color that you see, you begin to construct things. That is the idea of perception. You construct images by putting together certain pieces and separating other pieces. Now, a person who paints is a person who is able to simply put those colors in the proper way so that when you look at it, you begin to construct that yourself. Now, it is even possible to make you construct an image by just drawing some lines. The moment you see the lines, you begin to form an image. Like, say, for example, I draw a circle on a board. I draw a circle and then I two points on the circle and then one line perpendicular and another line, horizontal line. And then I ask you, what do you see? You say you see a face. That whole thing called face was your construct. So in a similar way, a painter could just paint a picture like that. And when you see something there and identify something as a face or a man or a woman or a tree or whatever you construct, is simply your construction. Now that construct is what is called sankhara in Buddhism. The word sankhara is used. So in other words, the world that we see is all the creation of the mental process. Now when we say this, some people who have been studying philosophy might say this is idealism, because there were philosophers in the Western world or Western philosophers. Among the Western philosophers, there was a time when three people, this very important part of Western philosophy, all I think British philosophers. One was Locke. Locke was a materialist. That means he pointed out that there is no such thing as a mind, there is only matter. Everything in the world that we see is made up of matter, and there is only matter. What we call the body is also made up of matter, and the brain is made up of matter. And what we call the mind is simply the activity of the brain and the nervous system. There is no other mind. That's what he pointed out. So he was called a materialist. Now there was another man who was a Christian bishop. He was, his name was Berkeley. He said, no, you're wrong. There is only mind. There is no such thing as matter. And he also had a good argument. He said, whenever you speak of matter, you are simply talking about what you perceive through your senses. You see something with your eyes. That is all a picture in your own mind. When you hear a sound, it's all something coming in your mind. When you talk about a smell, it's all in your mind. When you talk about a taste, it's all in your mind. Even when you touch something, it's a sensation that you begin to perceive. It's all your perception. All in your mind. Therefore, there is no such thing as matter. There is only mind. That is also correct. How the problem is, these are two concepts that erase the opposite. If you take up the idealist point of view, matter disappears. And if you take the materialist point of view, then mind disappears. So who is right? Then came a third philosopher. This was Hume. He said, well, you are both wrong, but partly correct. There is no such thing as matter. There is no such thing as mind. We can only talk about sense experience. There is only sense experience. There is no such thing as mind or matter. Both are creation of your mental process, which is the sense experience. So we can only talk about sense experience. Another philosopher who observed that and informed his own way of saying it was Immanuel Kant, who spoke about two things. That was what he called the phenomenon and the noumenon. What he called phenomenon is simply what is being experienced. That experience was accepted, but he put a new word for that. What is experienced is the phenomenon. But he said there must be something outside which is creating this, which we cannot see or know. And that thing that we cannot see is the noumenon. So, of course, then later another kind of philosopher came up and started saying that that noumenon can be known, that can be known only by mystics. And so that is what was called transcendentalism. So it went on like that. But the important thing is to know what did the Buddha say about it. The Buddha pointed out, he said, this is the all, the eye and what is seen, the ear and what is heard, the nose and what is smelt, the tongue and what is tasted, the body and what is touched, and this thinking process and what is conceived, the concept. That's all that we can talk about. If there is anyone who claims to be able to talk about something other than those things, he can be questioned and cross-questioned, and ultimately he will not be able to make good his boast. That's what he said. So he was taking a very similar position that Hume took. And even there was some person who came and asked, now if all sensory activity stops, what will be left behind? Then the disciple of the Buddha, Sariputta, said, if you say something exists, it is wrong. If you say something does not exist, it is wrong. Whatever you talk about is simply a category, because we are trying to categorize things. That's why we speak about things. Whenever we look at something and say, this is, say, a camera or something, you are categorizing person. You have seen cameras earlier, and so you said you put this into that same category or class. Every time we form a concept, we are classifying things. It's just a class, a category. So when you ask the question, what is there beyond perception, then you're asking for which category it belongs. You're trying to categorize something which is not a category. Now, this was also mentioned even by Kant. Same thing he said. So it's very interesting that at least there are few Western philosophers who have been thinking about this and come out with solutions. But the important thing is that what the Buddha points out is that we have formed a concept of existence. The word that we use in Buddhism is bhava. Bhava means existence. Now, when we talk about existence, we are talking about the existence of what we see outside and what we see inside. What we see outside, we call the world as a general term. And what we see inside, we call the self. So we have formed two concepts, the self and the world. We can call this the subject and the object. The object is what is outside, the subject is what is inside. So we believe the subject exists and the object exists. So when we talk about seeing something, we always think the subject came into being, and then there is an object, and then the subject and the object come together, and that is seeing, or hearing, or smelling, or tasting, or touching, or thinking. All this is, that whole experience becomes a relationship between the subject and the object. So we are all the time thinking of subjects, objects, and relationships. And the relationship can come in the form of an emotion. It can come in the form of an emotional attachment to something pleasant, or a hatred of something that is unpleasant. Or it can come in the form of fear, or worries and anxieties. These are all emotional reactions. This is all that we are experiencing. So the normal experience of existence is the experience of subject, object, and relationship. And that relationship is creating unhappiness. Because all these subjects and the objects are impermanent. So all relationships become impermanent. So you have falling in love and then getting divorced, and then all the problems arise in the world. All the fighting, quarreling, all that is simply this relationship between subject and object. So what the Buddha points out is, we can get out of this whole thing. Because this existence is simply a creation of the soul, the mental process. So I don't want to go deeply into this at this point. We'll be dealing with these things later. So you can ask further questions. Yeah?
In your last lecture, you mentioned like pursuing pleasure. Can you define what these pleasures are, and how should somebody react in a skillful or healthy way towards these pleasures?
Well, that is also a good question. The point is, there are three kinds of sensation. This is the important thing to understand. There are three kinds of sensation: the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral. Those are the three kinds of sensation. We have to see ourselves as organisms in an environment. We have to forget about ourselves. Just look at yourself as an organism. Organism is like a machine. All the difference is the machine is not living. The organism is living. That's the only difference. But I think last time I spoke about the difference between living and non-living. But the important thing is, this organism has these five senses, and the senses are being stimulated by the environment. And it is at this stimulation that you begin to experience a pleasant sensation or an unpleasant sensation or a neutral sensation. And what happens is, there is this automatic tendency of the whole human body to react to the pleasant sensation with desire, unpleasant sensation with hatred, and the neutral sensation, of course, you don't react that way. But it gives you a feeling of just existence. That's the problem. So, do that. We have to understand the whole process of reaction and to see the reaction as an impersonal process. If you personalize the reaction, then you can't get rid of it. Normally, we personalize that whole reaction. When you have a desire for something, you think, oh, I desired it. When you hate something, you say, I hate it. That means you are personalizing the desire, or personalizing the hatred, or personalizing the fear, or personalizing the worry. Right? Now, if you don't do that, if you can see how it is happening, here is the stimulus coming. The moment the stimulus comes, then there is the first part of the reaction is what is called the cognitive part of the reaction. You cognize or recognize something. Right? Say you walk on the street and you see a nice looking girl going. The moment you see that nice looking girl, then that is cognition. You have cognized. The moment you have cognized, your past memories also get into this, and a desire arises. That's how it happens naturally. A desire arises. Now, with the coming of the desire means a physical change takes place. You see, messages are sent from the brain to the gland, maybe the sexual glands, and then these sexual hormones are being secreted into the blood, and this goes to various parts of the body, and then changes take place in the body itself, and then, of course, you are being controlled now by your hormones. But you don't know that. You think you are doing it. I have this. You personalize that whole thing. So instead of doing that, if you can simply observe what is going on, that observing itself stops that. And the other thing is that this also produces tension. That whole emotional excitement produces tension in the body. The muscles become tense. And this tension makes you uncomfortable. And then you want to get rid of this discomfort. And the way you see to get rid of the discomfort is to get what you want. So you might want to go and talk to this girl, or maybe make an appointment and meet her again, or all kinds of plans you begin to form. And then your tension will be released only when you have got what you wanted. Till you have got what you wanted, your tension will remain and make you uncomfortable. So you have to see this happening to you. But normally we don't see this thing. We don't even know what is going on. And you begin to personalize and you begin to do all kinds of things, mischief, and then you get into trouble also sometimes. Huh? You know that, huh? So this is the problem. So this is what the Buddha called dukkha or suffering. Because every time we desire something, we are not able to get it. Every time we hate something, we are not able to get rid of it. Every time we fear something, we are not able to run away from that. And this produces all the worries and anxieties of life. And this is what today people call stress. And they pay a lot of money to learn how to manage stress. So you see, and then psychotherapy and all those things come into this. So the important thing is to learn what is going on and see that this emotional excitement is actually a disturbance of the mind. Your mind was calm at first and you are quite happy. But the moment you see this object, you become unhappy as your mind is disturbed. So if you want happiness, what you have to do is not to be carried away by this emotion and go and act and release tension that way, but learn to observe what is happening and you can relax the body completely and calm the mind. So it's calming the mind that can get rid of the emotion, not by suppressing or repressing or doing any of those things. You have to learn to relax the body and calm the mind. That's the important thing.
Well,
yeah.
That's okay.
This sort of follows what you just said. The question I'm about to ask is in the same area of the comments you just made. But I wonder if you could talk about obsessions. Why is it that thoughts come into my mind or things like that, and they just stay there, and I can observe them, but they're still there, and they're always there, it seems like, and I know what you're talking about, the witness. I look at them, and yet the thoughts and the feelings still remain there. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's also a very good question, and the important thing to know is, once the emotion has been aroused. I said it is a physical thing. It's not a mental change. It's a physical change. And because it is a physical change, it is more like heating. If you have a hot plate, you switch it on, it becomes hot. You switch it off, the heat doesn't go at once. It will go only very slowly. Very slowly the heat will begin to disappear. So when you look at the thought, it won't disappear at once. This is the reason. Because the physical hormone is still there in the body. The hormone doesn't disappear simply because you saw it. But if you can wait and be patient, and also you can do some exercise, which will also help you to get rid of the hormone, and gradually it will subside. But if you become impatient, then again, you're producing more hormones from the other direction. And if you begin to stick with those mental pictures, the other important thing is the mental picture. Every time an emotion is aroused, there is a picture formed in the mind. If it is anger, it is about a quarrel that you had. Or if it is a romantic thing, then you'll be seeing that object again in the mind as a picture. And if you keep on focusing on that object, then of course, it will become worse. So this is why you have to take your mind away from that picture. This is why the process of relaxation alone is not enough. You have to learn to change the picture in your mind. This is the purpose of meditation. Meditation is learning to change the picture, like changing channels on TV. You can change. Press a button and it changes. So like that, you can change the picture. So when you meditate, simply looking at the breath is not enough, or just sitting is not going to help. The important thing is, even when you are sitting, you must learn to relax, become aware of the tensions in the body, and learn to relax. And the other thing is, learn to change the picture in your mind. So if this picture is sort of forcing itself onto your mind, it is happening because the body tends to project the picture into your mind automatically. It's the change in the body itself that is doing that. So the mind begins to influence the body begins to influence the mind. It becomes a vicious circle. So you have to break that circle. One is to learn to consciously relax. The other is to learn to change the picture. So this is why the Buddha, if it is a sexual desire, the Buddha taught a method of getting rid of that picture. But to get rid of the picture, you have to first practice this when your mind is not disturbed. And that is to do what I call the anatomical meditation. You think of the anatomy of the body. You can take a book on anatomy and look at the pictures and think of that and think of the anatomy of the body. And if you practice that meditation, not when you are sexually excited, but when you are in a calm state, keep on thinking of this anatomy. After some time, whenever the sexual excitement comes, you can think of the anatomy. So when you think of the anatomy of the body, you are looking at the inside of the body, not the outside of the body. It's difficult at the beginning, but you have to learn to practice that meditation for a while before you can really make use of it. It's like a knife. If you get a knife that is blunt, you have to first sharpen the knife before you can use the knife to cut. So in a similar way, you have to practice that meditation when you are in a calm state, and when it becomes a strong meditation, then you can use that to attack the wrong kind of thought that you want to get rid of. That's how it's done. Any other question? You have one? No more question. That means you have understood. That's good, huh? So next time we'll be discussing, we have stopped the discussion about the Buddha. And next time we'll be discussing the teachings of the Buddha. And we begin with what I would call the cosmology, which is the cosmos, about what did the Buddha speak about the world outside, how he saw the world outside. You will find that he saw the world in a very similar way to modern astronomers and people like that, but he saw more than that by seeing other worlds. That is, through his psychic powers that he developed, he was able to see other worlds that the normal human eye is not able to see. We don't hear of these things in the books. So maybe when I finish my book, one day you'll be able to read that. So we'll be speaking about that next time. So you could come and listen to that. So if you don't have any further question, we can bring this to an end. So sure you don't have any more questions, huh? Okay, I will just chant a blessing to bless you, bring you good health, happiness, and success in whatever you do. Listen with devotion. Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakkhandu sabba devata sabba buddhano bhavena sada sutti bhavantu te. Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakkhandu sabba devata sabba dhammano bhavena sada sutti bhavantu te. Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakkantu sabba devata sabba sanghanu bhavena sada sutti bhavantu te. May you all be well, comfortable, peaceful and happy. Sukhi.